So there's a lot of things I want to talk about this evening, and I'm not sure where to begin. So I guess I have to start somewhere. So I'll try to start just at the beginning. It always seems like a good place to start. So as I said earlier this evening, when we really look at what Buddhist practice or Dharma practice is kind of offering us, is this idea that we do suffer in ways that are pretty unnecessary. And I don't think it takes very long to kind of diagnose that as being true. And, you know, what can we do about that? And what is the purpose of this kind of practice? And so one of the things that makes it a little challenging, I think, is being careful that we don't compartmentalize like a meditation practice as something that I do, and then my life is this other thing that I do. And I think that we need to be able to kind of integrate my meditation practice and the life that I'm living. Because sometimes what can happen, I think also in the arena of like mindfulness-based stress reduction, is we kind of get in this bad strategy of thinking meditation practice is just sort of this thing that I do to alleviate the symptoms of my suffering. Which is cool, I suppose, if that's your interest, and I think that's a lot of times the preliminary interest, because I want to alleviate some of these symptoms. But the Buddha doesn't really deal in symptomology, he more deals in causes. So would you like to reduce or alleviate the symptoms of your suffering, or would you just like to eradicate it all to begin with? Just like just completely liberate yourself from that. I prefer the liberation process. Now, of course, having been somebody who's been doing this for a while, as I have engaged in this sort of liberation-based practice, the symptoms haven't been alleviated. That's one of the byproducts. But that's not been my focus. And so one of the things we could say in a very pragmatic way, and when I work with people one-on-one, I offer this, is how do we cultivate a liberation-based lifestyle? I want my whole lifestyle to be rooted and to be guided by this idea of liberation. And I talked a few months ago about right livelihood, or what we do for work, which is an interesting topic, I think, because mostly when we come to these Dharma talks, or if we read a book on Buddhism, or we listen to podcasts, or so on and so forth, people don't talk about right livelihood so much. Nor do I want to talk about this evening, but I want to point out the fact that in the arena of my life, and very much so currently, one of the big topics of suffering for me has been, what do I want to be when I grow up? You know, what do I want to do in this world? And there's this parallel, or these two kind of confronting ideas that we find. There's like, A, I need to make money, right? Let's be real. And there's also the things that I'm interested in want to do. And a lot of times, those two don't fall in the same camp. Anybody here have a job that you feel like you mostly just do for the money? Right? Sure. Right. And if you were offered sort of something else that was more in line with your desires and interests, you probably would jump ship pretty quick if that was available to us. And so if we want to kind of use practice as a way to inform all the areas of our life, then I think we have to be pretty clear about how we're going to go about doing that. And so I think in a very basic way, especially living in our culture, and I struggle with this. I'm actually currently in this struggle as I speak of, you know, what's valuable. So like, what's valuable to us? And when we look at the practice, the technique and the strategies and the Buddhist teachings can be seen as a very objective way to view experience. So we could look at the Buddhist teaching. We could say that the Dharma is a map that can be followed for any individual to obtain liberation in this lifetime if followed But the problem with that analogy is that when I take that map into my territory, everybody in this room has a completely different territory. We all have completely different desire systems. We all have completely different relational struggles. We're all actually very, very, very different. So we have to be careful when we start to enter into practice that we don't try to abandon this idea of self, or we don't want to be careful we don't abandon what's important to us for some kind of like Buddhist ideal. Like, I just want to be a Buddhist now and just like forget about all my troubles and woes and my dramas and all my sort of bullshit. And I just want to rise up and be like a awakened Buddhist practitioner, which I've not met any of those yet. I don't think I've met many people who even claimed to be at that place. Does this make sense? Are you with me? I'm trying to kind of make a play for there being this kind of, there is these teachings that are being offered, and then this, how do we apply those to our life in a way that we can actually have the life that we want to have, right? And so when we look at what we do in practice, so if we look at what we're doing in Buddhist practices, we're basically doing this thing called cultivation, sometimes called bhavana, is that we're trying to, in a very simple way, we're trying to cultivate wholesome mind states, we're trying to cultivate positivity and kindness and awareness and forgiveness and compassion and all these beautiful Buddhist ideas that we all know about. We want to cultivate those on one end. And on the other end, we want to kind of eradicate, or at least in the short term, reduce things like greed and hatred and delusion and, you know, jealousy and blaming and all of these kind of things that we do. Right? But if we're honest with ourselves, sometimes we come into practice and we realize that actually we had it all backwards. I've been cultivating blaming and hatred and unfairness and how come and jealousy. And I know that when I first started practicing and I became familiar with my mind, I was like, yeah, I've been really engaging in all these strategies that have not really been so helpful to me. So we want to cultivate the wholesome, and we want to kind of alleviate, reduce, and ultimately eliminate these unwholesome mind states. Not so that we can become like good Buddhists or anything like that, but just so that actually we can be happy. So that these ideas are actually in our own best interest to be able to do that. And so when we sit in practice and we actually come face to face with our direct experience, we often find that we come into contact with a really complex, you know, matrix of both of these things. And we see that we have both of these qualities on our hard drive, and we try to kind of sort that out. And one of the things I think that we have to be very clear about when we start to try to integrate mindfulness into all the areas of our life is one of the first things we have to be able to recognize is that what we're actually learning how to do is to navigate complexity. Life is not black and white. You know, life is not this or that. I'm having a good day or a bad day. I'm a good person or a bad person. I live in the right city or I live in the wrong city. I have the right partner or if I don't have the right partner. I should be single. I should, you know, it's like there's this or that. And actually, in one of the teachings, the Buddha talks about craving as being this cause of suffering. He says that what craving does is it constantly is obsessing in this or that. Are you familiar with this or that? Do you want this or do you want that? And it's like, dude, I want other. I want something else, right? And so we kind of have to begin to realize that this Dharma thing is very slow, right? It's anti-immediate gratification, which is completely countercultural, right? So we come up against this very, very, very real paradox right out of the gate is, do I just want immediate gratification, or do I want to cultivate a lifestyle and a process of living that's going to take maybe the rest of my life and longer? It's like, I just want like Uber Eats and Netflix, man. Like, forget this long cultivation shit. Right. But I think many of us, if we end up in a room like this and I know many of you, we've seen the immediate gratification thing kind of, we've been burned by it so many fucking times that we oftentimes wake up to the fact of like, you know what, this is just not what I'm looking for. You know, I'm actually over trying to just get the next hit of what would feel good for a momentary experience. So we kind of have to make a choice to some degree. And unfortunately, we have to kind of remake the choice over and over and over and over and over again because we, like, forget. You know, which is why I spent very happily 5 hours at the air-conditioned mall today because it was so much better than my 95-degree house. And I went with the immediate gratification on that one, but don't feel like I caused any undue suffering. So we have to be careful, too, that we don't turn this into kind of this denying ourselves basic pleasures of the world, because that's extreme. So this middle way that the Buddha speaks of is so hard, because middle is always complex. Always. We're always in the middle of kind of things that are happening. And this term that the Buddha speaks of so eloquently is this term equanimity, which we could say, dare I say, if we have a goal in practice or we have a goal in life, is we want to establish this experience of equanimity, which is really being able to arrive into complex situations and seeing that life is both beneficial and struggle, that it's tragic and it's beautiful, it's joy and it's sorrow, it's gain and it's loss, it's pleasure and pain and praise and blame and all these kind of opposites, polarization. And how do we not become obsessed in the polarized view and actually rest in the middle? Equanimity literally means there in the middleness. I always feel like I'm in the middle of something. I'm in the middle of a fight with my friend. I'm in the middle of moving. I'm in the middle of my job. I'm in the middle of my week. I'm in the middle of my day. I'm in the middle of my... I always feel like I'm in the middle, and I always feel like a degree of stress associated with that perspective. I'm always in the middle of something that feels like aggravation or disappointment for me. And actually, that's really how it is all the time. So can we kind of learn how to be up for that challenge of being like, yes, and I'm willing to do this slow travel of walking a path that is going to get me hopefully in the direction that I want to go. And that means I need to put down the dead end of immediate gratification. And I also need to put down the other side of that, which is the dead end of sort of any type of a poverty mentality that we don't have, that we might have, or we feel undeserving of certain things, right? And so some people are sort of the greedy striver people who are like, no, I'm actually going to get all the, I'm going to make sure the conditions of my life are so that anytime I want immediate gratification, I have the resources to obtain it. And we know, especially in this town, we see that there's people who have kind of done that one. None of them seem to be that particularly all that happy, but so be it. But then there's the other side of the coin where we might become, feel undeserving of anything, or we have this kind of poverty mentality, or we feel like we should be happy with the conditions that we have. And we actually don't produce or cultivate the right kind of efforts to move in the direction of what's valuable to us. And so the Buddha calls these both things dead ends. That both of those extremes are dead ends, right? And I tend to be historically have been sort of the poverty mentality type of, like I'll really, really want something, but I'll either be afraid that I won't get it, or I'll think to myself that I don't deserve it, or I'll be so disappointed that I won't get it that I'd actually just deal with the shitty conditions I have right now rather than the potential future disappointment of trying something and failing. Right? You know, and how much of these ideas I'm talking about do we find kind of color or filter through our psychological function as we go through life, as we go through the world? And so a couple of the suttas that the Buddha speaks about, he speaks to this idea very clearly in one teaching called Irrigating the Field, which is one of my favorite ways that he teaches. He calls it Irrigating the Field, And he makes this analogy of waking up to the practice, or waking up to Dharma, or just waking up to the potential of there having, that there actually might be another way to go about life that we had not been introduced to previously. And he says that oftentimes when we arrive into that experience, that it's like going into a barren wasteland, where it's just like dry and hot and desert, and it feels empty, and feels actually almost like an abandoned building. And so if we find that experience, that either we become overwhelmed or scared, and we kind of withdraw from that because it's too much, or we feel depressed, or we realize that we have all the resources we need to irrigate that field, and that we have access to sunlight, and we have access to warmth, and we have access to water, and we have access to all of these things, and that what we learn how to do through cultivation, which I use that analogy a lot because I believe that the Buddha himself, the reason why he speaks so eloquently in the way of cultivation is because he grew up in a time and a place where agriculture and cultivation and the idea of seed and fruit would have been something that kind of he was really, really aware of. So he, to some degree, and I don't know if this is true, but this is the way I hold it, is because he realized that the physical world thrived on this idea of cultivation, that there were seeds and fruit, and if you planted the seeds in the right type of ground, and you gave them the right type of water and sunlight, and you gave them care and attention, that those things would grow and they would thrive, and it would allow the whole landscape, and it would allow life to flourish. Because he grew up on an alluvial plain in the Ganges River in northern India, which was at the time and place was a thriving, thriving agricultural community. So he would have been very, very aware of these ideas. And we could say, and I feel that it's true, is that he just said, well, if that's true for the external world, maybe that's actually true for the internal world. Maybe that's true for the human mind-heart experience. Maybe the idea of cultivation would work in the same way that it works in the external world, which I think is a pretty easy idea to get behind. So we, you know, for us to have the life that we want to have, we have to acknowledge that it's a slow grind, and that it's going to take constant care and constant attention and patience and all of these things. It's going to take not immediate gratification. I mean, you wouldn't drop a seed in fertilized soil and come back the next day and be like, what, no cherries? I just planted a seed yesterday. No sprout even? Fuck this. I'm just going to go to Vons. Right? But we do that, don't we? I do that all the time. I can't even feel bad for even saying this to you right now, because I find myself struggling with this all the time. And so that we look at it, if we look at it in a series of strategies, I think the most common way to kind of work with this is the reality of the Four Noble Truths, which is the idea that all of the Buddhist teachings can fit inside of the Four Noble Truths. In one story they say, just as the footprint of the elephant, all of the other creatures in the jungle footprint fits inside the elephant's footprint, that also just all of the things that I teach also fit inside of the Four Noble Truths. And I think when me and Chris Crotty were here yesterday, and I'm going to steal a little bit from him because he's so smart. He talks about, and also a way that I also teach that comes from the work of Stephen Batchelor, is actually seeing these Four Noble Truths as tasks to perform, that actually they're things to do. They're not ideas to believe in. So this is where I would say Buddhism is actually not a belief system. It's a behavior system. It's a system of behaving and living and engaging in life that's very, very pragmatic, that's very, very hands in the soil. It's not a dogmatic thing, belief system that leads to some destination. It's actually, it's really cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, that's where they got that shit from. You know, it's like we have to understand some things, we have to do some things, and if the things we understand and the things that we do lead to happiness, then keep doing those. If the things we understand and do lead to suffering, stop doing those. I mean, it's almost that simple. But, you know, we don't always get that right. Right? We don't always get that one right. And so this first idea of the first noble truth is that when we look at the parallel of that, is the first thing that we have to do is we have to be honest about the difficulties in our life. If you want to overcome difficulties and overcome struggles and deal with the reality of suffering, you actually have to have a really good idea of how that stuff works, which takes, you know, a lot of self-honesty. And I think this works very well in our Western context as well, even in a therapeutic context, right? If you go see a therapist or a counselor, what the first thing you do is you sit down and you say, yeah, man, I got some difficulties in my life, and that's why I'm here. You know, we wouldn't pay $200 an hour to talk to somebody about sports and weather. You get right in there and you get right to work. You're like, let me tell you about this. Let me tell you about my past. Let me tell you about, you know, that's how that works. Any therapeutic process carries with it a component of being honest about difficulties in our life, right? And at the same time as we have to be honest about the difficulties in our life, we also want to be optimistic and make sure that we're realistic about our desires and hopes and so forth. Right? So we have to be, to some degree, realistic about where we want to go and what we want to do, and being able to look at, as we look at the difficulties in our life, we also want to look at some of the directions that we might want to head in. So we don't want to become suffering focused, which can happen quite often in a Buddhist context. We also want to look at the other side of the coin. But ironically, what I've noticed is the more honest I am about the struggles in my life, the more optimism seems to arise out of that experience. Right? And that's sort of why all this stuff tends to work. So we have to do that. And then we have to, in the second noble truth, what we have to do is we have to be aware of the causes. We have to be aware of the beliefs that we have, the behaviors that we engage in, the things that we do, the things that we believe. We have to be pretty aware of what's causing the suffering, what's causing the difficulties, what's causing the distress and disappointment and aggravation. What's the cause? You know, we want to understand the cause. We don't just want to understand the symptoms. Right? Again, back to that analogy. We don't just want to alleviate or reduce the symptoms, which is kind of what Western medicine does a lot of times, right? Don't you want to go right at the cause and eradicate the cause? Right? And so the more that we become aware of the things that cause that, we oftentimes feel inspired or encouraged to step away from that, and that oftentimes means stopping doing certain things that cause suffering. And at the same time, developing or starting doing things that are more in line with actually our values and our desires. Which again, this is why a subjective view on these practices can be very helpful, because everybody in the room here has different desires and different values and different conditions in our life. So we kind of have to know our own territory and our own subjective reality quite well, which we already do, but there's so much denial and fear and oh man, it gets messy. We don't want people to know how fucked up we are, you know? Kind of theory. So everybody walks around pretending like everything's okay all the time. And that gets old pretty fast, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And so as we move into kind of this liberation-based lifestyle, if we can do these first two strategies, which isn't hard to do, but it also requires that we constantly revisit them. We'd be honest about these difficulties in our lives and the struggles and what's wrong, what's actually really, really wrong. And a lot of times we don't want to say. I don't want anybody to know how upset I am, how disappointed I am, how hard my life has been. We kind of keep that stuff neatly tucked away, you know, and that's where the denial and what I have found is what happens for me is in my attempt to do that, I always end up having these side effects. Right? I always end up engaging in strange and interesting behaviors to try to medicate or to reduce these symptoms, right? Self-medication, which is basically addiction, which seems to be alive and well in the world today. So we want to be able to become, if we can do these first two, become aware of the causes, we start to become more optimistic about their eradication. Right? And I think we could all sit here and go around and probably give examples of things that we used to struggle with that either we don't struggle with anymore or that we actually don't struggle with at all. This idea of we've probably all experienced some degree of liberation in our lives. And I find it very interesting that people tend to not give themselves very much credit for that. You know, we feel like we should have known better, or we should be by now. Do you have any things that you feel like you should be, have done by now, or should be over by now, or should be able to deal with by now, or should be all fucking day long? Does that ever help? No. All right. So sometimes it might be more helpful if we focused and placed our attention and became more aware of some of these things that we've already been able to overcome and challenges that we have been able to deal with or address, whether however large or small the amount. In colloquial terms, this is what they call resilience, emotional resilience, and this is kind of a pop culture, pop psychology term, which I think is a really great term, and I think it's really, really important because I think when we talk about the Third Noble Truth, the idea that suffering can be ended, that you can end suffering for yourself in this lifetime through your own efforts, which is a really fucking cool idea. That actually we have to be aware of some of the ways that we've already done that, because we all can give examples of ways in which that has been true and try to pay attention and be more aware of that and actually kind of cultivate that state, that sense of optimism or that sense of resiliency. Right? But what do we feel like? Well, I'm resilient but not resilient enough. I'm not as resilient as I should be by now. And if I would be that resilient, then I wouldn't have all these problems, but I have all these problems, and I'm this person who has all these problems because I don't have enough resiliency, and you know, and on and on and on the horrible narration goes. Right? And resiliency, in its very basic, you know, definition, is that it's the overcoming of a challenge. Right? And so, because it's the overcoming of a challenge, you can't have resiliency without having a challenge. So it's like, again, as we sort of do this first skill of being honest about the difficulties of our life, we're confronted with a challenge and we're able to overcome that challenge. We're confronted with a challenge and we're able to overcome that challenge. Right? And the challenges, they just don't stop coming. Right? I don't think that's going to happen. So again, as we start to develop these, really what we're practicing here, and this cultivation of awareness and mindfulness and all these kind of ideas, which can become confusing quickly, we just really, what we develop are internal resources. Is that we're able to use our own mind, heart, body as a resource for liberation in any given moment. Right. And that, you know, every single day there will be varying degrees of challenges that need to be overcome. And so we have to be aware of challenges when we've overcome them and kind of give ourselves credit and have that appreciation or that gratitude or that mudita we talk about. Appreciation, appreciative joy. Like, hey man, wow, I handled that really well. You know? Sometimes I feel like I'll be like, oh man, I really just dodged a bullet there. I'm like, I didn't dodge a bullet there. I totally overcame that challenge. I did that. It wasn't easy to do that. And, you know, and then what we start to see is that this eightfold path, which is eight things, so there's no way we're going to get through all that. But that's the skill. So we become skilled in their removal. We become skilled in the removal of the causes of these things that create all the difficulty and the suffering and the stress in our lives. We become skilled in the removal of these things. You do it. Right? You learn how to do that. And so when we start to look at one of the things about Buddhist practice that I've noticed in my own experience is it's not one of these things, unfortunately, where you can kind of take what you want and leave the rest, which we hear in other places in certain times. I've tried that sort of cherry picking thing, and it's not really worked out so good for me. And at the same time, we also have to make sure that these ideas and these practices are true and useful to us. So we don't want to dismiss things that don't make sense, but we don't necessarily want to go all in until we know for sure, which again is a very middle idea, you know, because that's what I do. I either devalue or idealize. Either this is no fucking good and get rid of it, or this is gonna answer all my problems. Neither of those strategies do I recommend to anybody. As trying to be in the middle of that. I was like, okay, this doesn't make sense to me yet. I'm not so sure about this yet. Maybe I need to do some more research. Right? And at the same time, you're like, this is it. This is my thing. I'm just going to do it. Maybe I also need some more research there. So trying to kind of bringing these practices to every single thing that we do. The Buddha uses this term, sati sampajana, which is mindfulness of activities, or being aware of what you're doing whilst you're doing it. And that includes literally every single thing under the sun. Being aware of what you're doing whilst you're doing it. Sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, paying your taxes. I know for me, I spend a lot of time doing things that I actually don't want to be aware of what I'm doing while I'm doing it. Which is why this little guy comes in so handy. Like, I can, you know, I will watch TV and scroll my phone at the same time. That's kind of crazy. Do you do that?
Yeah.
You totally do that, don't you? You love it too, don't you? You're just, which one's better? Big screen, little screen, that's what I call it. Right? Some of you are really sick and you probably have an iPad too and you got three going. It's like, The safety of multi-distraction makes my nervous system feel so safe to have so many different things to use to avoid what I'm feeling. Right? And so when we practice, we actually put all that stuff aside and we really kind of turn towards that experience. So I want to open it up, but I also want to say that some of you already know, and some of you maybe don't necessarily care so much because you don't come here all the time, but many of you I've known for years, and many of you have been sitting with me for a long time, that I'm actually leaving Los Angeles in a couple weeks and moving to rural Colorado, which has been a decision and a choice that me and my partner have been kind of chewing on for quite some time now, right? For quite some time now that we have kind of kept to ourselves, because there was a lot of hurdles and obstacles and things that needed to happen for us to be able to do that may or may not have gone down. So it's actually been a very exciting and very joyful and very fun experience, and it's been totally stressful and totally frustrating and full of all kinds of uncertainty, and you know, we had to kind of navigate that, and I'm very happy that we have kind of been able to do that. So living in Los Angeles has been a very interesting experience. I'm not from here. I'm from Boston. And when I was a little kid, I wore a t-shirt, a Celtics t-shirt that said, I hate LA. So I had a lot of conditioning growing up being, you know, you probably, anybody who was around in the 80s, the Celtics-Lakers rivalry was very intense. So, go Celtics. So I think next week, I'm pretty sure next Sunday will be my last class here. And I think I'm teaching at Melrose this Wednesday. But I will be returning back periodically to do day longs or maybe some weekly classes when I'm in Los Angeles. I don't anticipate being here a lot, but I'm sure I will be here at times, and still will obviously teach with Against the Stream, and very happy for this community and the opportunity in the couple years I've been here. But LA is not a good fit for me. For a variety of reasons, and a lot of them actually has to do with resources. I didn't move here with a lot of resources, but the cost of living, and for me to do the work that's really valuable to me, for me to live in Los Angeles, I end up having to spend a lot of my time doing things I'm not particularly interested in doing, because those things afford me the luxury of money. So I'm looking for a much more simple lifestyle where there's more spaciousness, where the cost of living is much cheaper, where I can grow my own food. And I also feel somewhat irresponsible as a consumer. I feel like I buy and throw away a lot of things. I'm not pleased with the amount of Starbucks cups that I find in my car at the end of the week, and really feel like a little bit out of integrity with my relationship to the environment, which I'm sure I could live here and not do, but so it's not LA's fault that I throw away a lot of trash. So for me, it's just been a really big shift of wanting to have a more simple, spacious life where I have more time to practice. I haven't sat a meditation retreat in 2 years, which feels irresponsible as a Buddhist teacher, and teaching retreats and talking to people about the importance of sitting retreats, whilst not sitting retreats. So it gets very strange very quickly. Being a Dharma teacher is a very strange thing to do. And I find that I have not been able to do a lot of the things that have been very important to me, and have found it very complex to do those things, to find the time to sit and to find the time to be more environmentally aware and more conscious about the earth and the climate. So I'm going to try to put myself in a situation where the conditions are going to be more favorable for me to do so. So for those of you who I don't know, no big deal, I suppose. And for those of you, you can still find me. I'll be around. I'm also shifting more into teaching retreats, weekly classes. I've been teaching anywhere from 5 to 8 weekly classes a month for the last 7 or 8 years. Which I'm happy to teach these classes. It's fun for me, but I'm really much more interested in working with people on a more kind of deep level, I suppose. I don't like that word so much, but teaching retreats and residential retreats is really where my heart is these days. And also working with people, doing mentoring, which I'm now doing, and really working with people regularly on helping them kind of deepen their practice. And that's something that's been just much more interesting to me these days, so I find myself gravitating towards that kind of work. So thank you so much for your attention tonight, and any questions you have about the talk or the practice or about my move, I'm pretty open, so I will turn it over. So thank you.